Hello and welcome back to the Insights Podcast. I'm Philippa Lamb with our monthly roundup of accountancy news. This time, we're covering the main changes taking effect with the new tax year and progress on the provisions of the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Act. To shed light on those two topics, we're joined remotely this time by Stephen Ralph, Technical Manager in Tax, and Sally Baker, Head of Corporate Reporting Strategy. Hello, both. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As we know, the beginning of the tax year, it's always a busy time for accountants, but this April in particular is unusual in the sheer number of changes coming into force. Stephen, why is this year busier than most other years?
I think that's possibly because we've got a combination of some measures that we've known about for a while, which are just beginning to take effect now, and also some new measures coming out of the spring budget. So in terms of the old measures, I think a good example is the abolition of basis periods for sole traders. So this was announced a few years back. It was consulted on and we had an implementation period, including a transitional year. But this year, 24-25, it is only now just taking a full effect. And I think the spring budget as well, we've had a few announcements from that, which take effect now. A good example again would be the national insurance cuts. So for employees, the rate went down from 10% to 8%. For the self-employed from 9% to 6%. And that was widely trailed ahead of the budget, but what we didn't expect is that it would apply from the 6th of April.
There is a lot, as you say. So I think we're going to limit ourselves to the main changes for accountants to be alert to. Should we look at measures affecting individuals first?
Yeah, so I think if I had to pick out one measure for individuals, I would go with the High Income Child Benefit Charge, or HICBC. So this claws back child benefit for high earners. It does that in full, where income is above the upper threshold. And it does it in part, where income is between the lower and upper thresholds. And it's got a number of problems with it. But some of them relate to the fact that those thresholds were unchanged since the HICBC was introduced in 2013.
Just remind us what they were, Stephen.
So the thresholds, the lower threshold currently is £50,000. The upper threshold is £60,000.
Okay.
So at the budget, the Chancellor did announce that those thresholds will be increased. So that lower threshold will now go from £50,000 to £60,000, and the upper threshold from £60,000 to £80,000. Now that's really good news for an awful lot of families. I think some roughly 485,000 families are expected to benefit from this. But there is one important point to note, and that is of that figure, there are somewhere around 180,000 families which will actually have to take some action in order to benefit from these changes.
Okay.
That's because they haven't claimed child benefit in the past, and that may be because they didn't want to get embroiled in the HICBC. So to benefit from these changes, they will now need to reconsider that decision and look at claiming child benefit.
And who, if you're a couple, who is responsible for paying the tax charge?
Yes, it's the highest earner of the couple.
And if your income is over the threshold, you can choose, can't you, to kind of get the payments and pay the tax charge at the end, or you can just opt out, is that right?
It's even more complicated than that, actually. There's a third option where you can claim child benefit but opt to receive no money. The reason you would do that is it gives you some protection when it comes to contributory benefits. So unfortunately, the HICBC has really complicated things over the last few years, so this is a welcome simplification.
There was talk, wasn't there, making this about household income rather than individual income, but that hasn't happened, has it?
So the Chancellor did mention that, and he did say they were looking to do that on or before April 2026. But the problem is that is quite a significant change for HMRC. So although it would be a great simplification, it makes the HICBC fairer, it would mean a lot of changes to HMRC's processes and systems.
Shall we move on to sole traders? What's new for them?
Yeah, so one of the big things for sole traders is significant changes to the cash basis. So traditionally, businesses prepared their accounts and calculated their profits and losses on the accruals basis. But a few years back, the government introduced the option of using the cash basis instead. So essentially, you can elect to be taxed by reference to cash in and cash out for the year, which is a lot simpler and easier to understand. So the uptake of that was good, but perhaps not as good as the government wanted. So what it's done now is it's turned the system on its head, and essentially the cash basis will become the default. And if you want to use the accruals basis, you need to elect to do that. But importantly as well, they have removed some of the barriers to using the cash basis. So there was a cap on the amount of interest you could deduct in calculating your profit and loss. That's now gone. And there were also restrictions on what you could do with the loss in terms of relief, and that they have now gone as well.
Am I right in thinking there's been a bit of nervousness from accountants about this, who perhaps have been, as you say, more used to the accruals basis in the past?
And that's perfectly understandable, because I think the accruals basis probably gives a much more accurate position of where the business is. And also, obviously, accountants are much more comfortable with the accruals basis and the cash basis. So that, combined with those barriers I mentioned, I think did really put people off using it.
But the government prefers cash, presumably in part at least, because it makes digitization easier?
Yeah, I would think so. I think that's probably quite a key reason for this. So making Touch Digital, MTD, it's expected to come in to be phased in for self-employed from April 2026. And to make that possible, you kind of need to get rid of some of the complexities in the system. And this is a candidate for that.
Companies, finally, what would you say is the most significant change there?
Yeah, well, for companies, it's quite hard to look past R&D, really. And that's been the case for the last few years. So for accounting periods beginning on or after the 1st of April this year, we now have a new merged regime for R&D tax relief. And that's going to replace the legacy SME scheme and the legacy large company or RDEC scheme. So I think the main impact of that is probably going to be for SMEs, largely because that new regime is more similar perhaps to the RDEC than to the SME scheme. So they're going to have a more significant learning curve. Just to point out as well, it does also come on in addition to lots of other changes in the last few years, particularly around information requirements. So you do have to provide a lot more information to HMRC now when you make a claim.
So more onerous for SMEs, but the thinking here, there's been errors, there's been fraud. This presumably is an attempt to try and iron some of that out.
That's right, yeah. I think there's a few reasons why the government are doing it. That's probably the main one. I think also the concern that they don't get enough value back from their investment in R&D when it comes to SMEs compared to large companies. And also the actual scale of R&D tax relief and the cost of R&D tax relief has increased significantly over the last few years.
So Stephen, I know you're a regular on the new Tax Track podcast. You go into all this, don't you, I think, in more detail. Is it in the latest episode and the one before that?
It's in the latest one, yeah. We've just recorded it. Myself, my colleagues, Lindsay, and in particular, Richard, who's quite close to this. So we do give a really good overview of the new regime, but also pick out some of the kind of more challenging areas, especially around contractor relationships. So yeah, that's definitely worth a listen if you're interested in R&D tax relief.
So yes, anyone who really wants to dig into the detail, that would be the place to go. It's the Tax Track. You can listen to that on any podcast app, not hard to find. Where else would you point listeners, Stephen, if they want more information on what's changing this year?
Yeah, so in Taxline, we have a really useful table which sets out the key changes applying from April. Now, on the face of it, it gives you a quick overview of the changes, so you can get the key details very quickly, very easily. But you'll find that if you hover over it, you'll see it brings up more detail. And also, if that still isn't enough, say you want to do more detailed research, there are also links provided to other content. So ideally, that table will give you or direct you to everything you need to know.
We'll put a link to that, Stephen, in the show notes so that people can go straight there from the podcast. Thanks very much for that. Now, you might remember that we summarised the provisions of the Economic Crime and Corporate Transparency Act back in episode 63. The Act promised sweeping changes to companies' house reporting requirements for SMEs and where accountability lies for economic crime. Sally, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you.
It's been 6 months, hasn't it, since the legislation received royal assent, and the first set of changes, they came into effect on the 4th of March, didn't they?
So it was the end of October when we had royal assent. And the first set of changes have just come into effect from the 4th of March. So there's been a bit of a time delay in between, but that's been necessary just because of the volume of work going on behind the scenes.
Thinking about the points that you reckon are most important to be aware of right now, what would be your first thought?
The first one is about the new powers to query and remove information from the register that Companies House has. That's all aimed at making the register more reliable. So there's going to be some stronger checks on company names. There's going to be some data matching exercises to remove data that is inaccurate or that they know is inaccurate. And I think the priority at the moment for Companies House is really to look at people's whose names and addresses have been used for unlawful use or inappropriately. So they're currently processing, I believe, about 7,000 applications
already
to have names. Yep, about 7,000 already to have names and addresses That have been used without consent, removed from the register.
And I'm presuming they're expecting a lot more.
I expect so. Over time, as people know that they, you know, if they become aware of their details having been used fraudulently and know the company's house now have greater powers to act more quickly on that, then I'm sure they will be getting some more applications in due course.
There's a new definition, isn't there, on what companies can use as an appropriate registered office address? How does that work?
So every company has to have a registered office address. They've changed the definition of what an appropriate registered office address is. So now that definition means that anything delivered to the address has to come to the attention of a person acting on behalf of that company. It also needs to be an address where it's possible to obtain proof of delivery, acknowledgement of delivery. So what that means is that it can no longer be a PO box address. And there's about nearly 4,000 companies at the moment on the register that have PO boxes as their registered office address. So Companies House have been writing to all of those companies and asking them to change that to an appropriate address.
But you can still use an agent?
You can still use an agent. Yep, that's fine. And what it's also worth being aware of is that if your address is deemed to be inappropriate, then Companies House will change your address to a default address, which will be at Companies House. And the company then has 28 days to provide an appropriate address. And if they don't provide the appropriate address within that time frame, then Companies House can start the process to strike the company off the register.
Interesting.
So the other new requirement to be aware of is that companies will have to provide an email address as well to Companies House. So when completing the annual confirmation statement, you'll need to provide an email address that Companies House can use to communicate with the company. It's worth noting that that address won't be on the public register, though.
And you also have to confirm that the activities of the companies will be lawful, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So again, as part of the annual confirmation statement, or if you're setting up a company, you do it at the incorporation stage, you're going to need to confirm that the future activities, the intended future activities of the company, will be lawful.
More onerously, fees have gone up, haven't they?
Fees are increasing from the 1st of May. The fees at Companies House work on a cost recovery basis. So it's perhaps not surprising with all of the additional work that they will be doing that the fees are going to be increasing to cover all of that. So new fee structure comes in from the 1st of May. It's going to cost now £50 to incorporate a company, register a company. That's assuming you're doing it online. It will be more expensive to do it by paper. And the cost of the annual confirmation statement is also going up. And that will now cost about £34. Again, doing it online, it will be a higher cost if you do it by paper.
These are quite significant increases, aren't they?
They are quite significant, yep. So at the moment, you could register a company for £10 or £12, depending on how you do it. And the annual confirmation statement is about £13 at the moment. So they're not necessarily large sums of money, but percentage-wise, they are big increases.
Yeah, substantial. We are going to see more, aren't we? More changes in the autumn. And the one I think that is perhaps most significant there is ID verification beginning.
We're anticipating that they're going to start the process on that, like I said, in the autumn of 2024. There'll be various stages to this. First of all, if you're going to be a corporate service provider, so offering verification services, you will be able to apply from autumn, winter of this year. Individuals that want to verify their identity directly with Companies House, they'll be able to start doing that kind of late winter, early spring, and then that will all start to roll out in terms of directors and persons with significant control needing to have their identity verified with Companies House from kind of spring 25 onwards. All of these timelines are very much subject to change, but that is the plan at the moment.
What about the changes we know are coming to the way accounts are prepared and filed? Is that they're coming later, are they?
So I think they will be the last stage in the process. So I don't think we would expect much until perhaps the later end of 25, possibly even into early 2026. But like I said, the timelines are very subject to change at the moment. So a little bit too early to say, other than we're expecting the accounts changes to be after the ID verification, and we're anticipating those to start in the autumn of this year.
As you say, it's a hugely complex and costly reinvention, isn't it, of Companies House and its role. We've flagged resourcing with you before, I think, in the past, as a significant issue in this whole process. Has there been any progress on that?
Yeah, there definitely has. There's a YouTube video, which we'll put the link to in the show notes, I'm sure, that just shows the extent of the work that Companies House have already undertaken, and across government as well, the extent of the work that's been undertaken since the bill was introduced and then the Act was passed. And that's recruiting new staff, training new staff, building resources to raise awareness, informing stakeholders, the secondary legislation as well that's needed to actually bring these things into effect. They've implemented about 11 pieces of secondary legislation already, but I believe there's about 40 or so more to go. So that just gives you an indication of what a significant amount of work is involved to bring in all of the measures that are in the Act.
Yeah, I watched that video on YouTube. It's on the Companies House feed. It's fascinating, isn't it, with the sheer number of numbers in it about the work they've already done. As you say, the training hours, the volume of work, the numbers of things still to be done. It's fascinating.
You know, it is just a short video full of numbers, but it does kind of get the message home of just how much work and effort is going on in terms of getting this all into place.
Yeah, it's a surprisingly compelling watch, isn't it?
Yeah.
We are expecting a general election this year, of course. Do you feel that is invariably going to mean delays in secondary legislation and additional guidance?
I think it will be inevitable that things will slow down as a result of that. Obviously, during the election period, there will be limits on how much can be going on behind the scenes in terms of work on secondary legislation, etc. So that's why we say, in terms of the timelines that we know about at the moment, they are all very much subject to change.
OK, well, we'll get you back when we know more, Sally. But thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
That's it for this month. Head to the show notes for more information on the two stories we covered today. Join us later in the month for April's In Focus podcast. In the meantime, please do rate, review and share this episode, and subscribe to the series on whichever podcast app you like best. Daily, weekly or monthly newsletters from ICAW Insights with all the latest accountancy news are all available to you on the website too, if you'd like to sign up for them as well. Thanks for being with us.